Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. People with intellectual disabilities suffer the highest rate of sexual assault of any group in the United States, but prosecutors are often reluctant to take on these cases. NPR correspondent Joseph Shapiro has covered the issue in a special series this week entitled Abused and Betrayed. Check out the link to the series at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we'll consider Ohio's challenges and programs to protect people with intellectual disabilities. Joining us now by phone is NPR's Joseph Shapiro. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann.
This was a year-long investigation. What triggered your interest? How did you know there was a story here?
Oh, I've been covering disability issues for 30, 40 years. And it was actually people with intellectual disabilities themselves who kept telling me about this issue, who kept telling me about the sexual violence in their lives. And I did a series for NPR back in 2010 about sexual assault on college campuses, something that led to a change from the Obama administration, something I did with the Center for Public Integrity, and I've been writing about disability for years. So I thought two interests, I should do this story. It's been an open secret in this community that people with intellectual disabilities suffer from very high rates of sexual assault.
You got access to Justice Department data on sex crimes. How did you know what to ask for to sift this out?
From my coverage, I had known that the Justice Department had collected data on sexual assaults and crime against people with disabilities for a long time. In fact, when Mike DeWine was a senator in Washington, he in 1998, he sponsored a bill that required the Justice Department to collect crime data, data about crime against people with specifically intellectual disabilities. And the Justice Department used that law to actually do this much broader annual report that they do, where they look at crime against all people with disabilities, all crime against people with disabilities. They mention sexual assault briefly, but they don't break it down for people with intellectual disabilities. So I knew they had that data, and I went to them. I asked them to run that data, and they did. And they came up with this sort of stunning number for us that people with intellectual disabilities are sexually assaulted at a rate that's more than 7 times the rate for people without disabilities.
And just for listeners, of course, he's talking about former Senator Mike DeWine, now state attorney general and also a Republican candidate for governor in Ohio. What couldn't you get in terms of the data that you wanted or you think would tell more of the story?
Well, one thing we haven't figured out that there just isn't data on is how often these cases get prosecuted, how often they end in a conviction. We tried to get some state data. We asked states how often they get these reports and they follow up on these reports. A state agency that gets state or federal money is required to investigate any report of suspected sexual abuse. The numbers we got from the states were all over the place. In Texas, fewer than 1% of allegations were confirmed. In Florida, about 5% were verified. In Ohio, 23% were substantiated between 2012 and 2015. In Pennsylvania, 34% of the allegations were confirmed. One reason it's all over the place is that these are hard to confirm, and also I think as the in Ohio, as the State Department of Developmental Disabilities pointed out, that sometimes it's sort of apples and oranges from state to state, that some states count just the sexual assault, some are counting other kinds of sexual abuse. In Ohio, they count things including rape but also things like touching and groping, and also things like voyeurism and taking pictures of an individualism or promoting prostitution, which, by the way, turns out to be a problem. People with intellectual disabilities are vulnerable to that.
Human trafficking.
Correct.
All right. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the incidents and the challenges sexual assault of people with intellectual disabilities. My guest is Joseph Shapiro. He's a correspondent for NPR, and he's produced and reported on a series airing this week on NPR. If you want to get more on that series, you haven't heard any of it yet, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, and you can check out the whole thing. In general, what are the factors that make people who are intellectually disabled so much more vulnerable to abuse? They may seem obvious to people who have been covering the issue for a long time, but maybe since it's such an open secret, there's a lot of people who still don't know about it.
Yeah. Well, part of it is that they depend upon other people. And they're taught to trust other people. They need other adults to help them. Some need help with just with very few things, but it might be driving somewhere. And others who are in the series who've been victimized depend on other people to do everything from dressing them to toileting them to bathing them, right? Those are very personal things, to feeding them and giving them medication. So it's a wide range, but what's common is that they rely upon other people. They come in contact with a lot of other people. They're taught to go along with those other people. So and most of the staff and the family and the people who take care of them are extremely dedicated and do so much work and work so hard, and they're so professional. But occasionally you get somebody who's a predator. Mm-hmm. and unfortunately these are sort of easy targets.
Why has it been an open secret? Why isn't it talked about more often, Joe?
Well, I've struggled with that, Anne, and I think if you the people that I ask in the profession and people with intellectual disabilities themselves, they will answer that by saying there is a bias against us. There is a feeling that our lives don't matter, that we're not as important as everyone else. And I think that's correct. I think we tend to discount the lives of people with intellectual disabilities. And often, the other reason is that if there is an allegation, it's hard to bring these to trial. You mentioned that police and prosecutors are often reluctant to take these cases because someone with an intellectual disability may not be the best witness in court. They're often they're very literal and concrete thinkers. Abstract concepts, which are important in court, like time sequence, when did it happen, those can be difficult concepts for people with intellectual disabilities. So one of the stories I talked about a woman named Pauline,
yeah,
who was sexually assaulted. Her family had two houses, one in New York and one in Pennsylvania, and she'd been assaulted multiple times, but she couldn't remember where and when the dates. And the prosecutors in each place had difficulty because time sequence just wasn't something that she was able to establish well. Fortunately for her, she was assaulted by two boys in the house where she lived, and it was actually fortunate that those two boys confessed right away to police. And if that confession hadn't happened, the police in Pennsylvania probably would have dropped the case.
You know, what was interesting as a listener to the case about Pauline is that she wanted to talk about her case, and it was really it's unusual to hear somebody willing to share and able to share it despite her difficulties. She actually was very good at sharing the story.
Right. And I think, Anne, you know from covering this issue that we don't usually hear the voices of these people. And one reason that this investigation for me took a year, and I actually had been working on it sort of more longer, trying to find cases. But one reason it took so long was trying to find people whose voices we could use. There were issues of consent, people who were willing to talk about these cases. It took a while, but one of my goals in this series, and one thing that I think makes it different than other coverages that you hear a lot of voices of people with intellectual disabilities. The final piece, and by the way, we've run four pieces this week, and we have three next week, and okay. The last one on Thursday night will be just the voices of people with intellectual disabilities. And by the way, one thing I learned when I first started covering this area is that even somebody with an intellectual disability can be very wise, and they're very thoughtful, and they think about these issues deeply. And the last piece, Thursday night on All Things Considered, is just their voices being very thoughtful about how sexual assault affects them.
Right. I mean, intellectual disability is that. It's not an emotional disability necessarily.
It basically is a difficulty in learning in a traditional way and dealing with abstract concepts. It may also be a difficulty dealing with social cues. These are all things that make them even more vulnerable to sexual assault.
What did you learn about the kind of support out there that's available to victims? We're going to talk to some people in Ohio, but in general, is there enough? Are they well trained? What do we know?
There are very dedicated professionals to try to provide support. Rape crisis centers are now learning how to help people with intellectual disabilities. So there's a lot more than there's ever been. We need a lot more. There's a lot of training that goes on with police about how to help the survivors of sexual assault. So that's starting to change. That's starting to get better. I do another story. The second to last piece is on next Thursday morning on Morning Edition, where I talk to two therapists who specialize in counseling people with intellectual disabilities, specifically who've been the victims of sexual assault. Mm-hmm. And I just met with them, and they started telling their war stories, these horrible stories about the level of violence in their clients' lives. And I just let the tape recorder run, and I run some of that. But they'll also say that there's a lot of misunderstanding that people, when they've been the victims of sexual assault, they may not be able to express what happened. They act out. They maybe are destructive to property at a group home, or they hurt themselves, they hit themselves. And the typical result is that they're given medications, that they are medicated, and that the source of the issue is not resolved, that it's seen as a behavior, but the cause of the behavior is not addressed.
There was something in the NPR report, it might have been the first day, that struck me. Beverly France of Temple University's Institute on Disability said that when it comes to people with intellectual disabilities, we treat them as children. And it made me wonder, is there a larger message out there for how we even address this issue to children in general, including those who are intellectually disabled?
So I think that's right. The issue is that these are adults. They are sometimes vulnerable in the way children can be, because we talked about how they're easily manipulated or tricked, or they're trusting of people. But they are adults, and they have adult experiences. The story that I had on this past Tuesday morning on Morning Edition, we went to a sex education class. Sex education is one of the ways to deal with this problem, because people with intellectual disabilities often don't get the sex ed classes. They don't have the tools sometimes for identifying what's abuse or knowing how to stop it or how to deal with it. And in that class, every adult in that class said they wanted the same romance and relationships that all the rest of us want. They see their siblings and their parents, and they watch movies and see TV, and they want this just like anyone else would want. But they're often assumed to be childlike and not interested in romance, and that's not true. So they want those things, and so one solution is to help them to recognize those goals and to help them be able to have romantic relationships. It's hard when you're a person with an intellectual disability. You probably live at home, or you're in a group home. You don't have a lot of privacy. Mm-hmm. You don't have money. You probably don't drive. And the people in that story we're talking about how they wanted romantic relationships, but also the biggest barrier was often this history of sexual assault.
Joseph Shapiro, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Anne. And I hope people will go and find the series. You've linked to it, and yep, it's also at NPR.org.
All right. That's Joseph Shapiro. He's an NPR correspondent. His series on the incidents and the issues surrounding people with intellectual disabilities who are sexually assaulted, the rates more than seven times that of the general population in the United States. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. You can see the whole series, which continues with three segments next week on NPR. We'll continue our conversation about what's going on in Ohio and also hear from an expert who counsels people with intellectual disabilities, their loved ones, their caretakers. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. People who are intellectually disabled are more than seven times as likely as the general population to be sexually assaulted, but their cases are much less likely to be resolved in the criminal justice system. NPR has produced a multifaceted series that continues next week about the incidence of sexual assault of people who are intellectually disabled and the challenges for law enforcement in such cases. You can check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides to listen to that series and read more about it. We wanted a better picture, though, of how this issue is addressed in Ohio. Joining us is Executive Director of Crime Victim Services serving Allen and Putnam counties in central northwest Ohio, David Bouth. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also from the Center for Disability Empowerment, that's an independent living center in Columbus, Olivia Caldera. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Olivia, you manage the Speak Up, Stay Safe program, which educates people with intellectual disabilities on health and safety issues, including sexual assault. What did you make of the findings from the NPR investigation?
The NPR investigation hit on a lot of the things that we're seeing in Ohio. We did 23 trainings around the state, and 12 of those trainings were for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and 11 were for parents and professionals who work with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, which I'll refer to as probably IDD.
Okay.
And in every training, somebody was a victim of some type of abuse and assault, and so much goes unreported.
Was there any common denominator among those? Is there any common link besides the victim, you know, who the victim is? Are they perpetrators? Is there a commonality there?
I would say that it's a case-by-case basis, yeah, but there are some patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter in terms of functioning level or communication abilities. Most people are still vulnerable. They're almost all vulnerable, really. The patterns that Joseph talked about with isolation, dependency, yeah, the culture of compliance, so much of the lifestyle of people with intellectual disabilities is about following norms and people-pleasing. So there isn't a lot of empowerment and independence and ability to speak up for themselves. In terms of the perpetrators, what's really interesting is that we would ask the different groups, who do you think is most likely to abuse? And parents and professionals would say, people that you trust, people that you know, which is correct. That's the majority. And often the people with IDD would say strangers because they've been taught stranger danger, stranger danger.
Okay.
And it's a very scary and unsettling concept to realize that the people who are most likely to abuse are those that we trust. And it's not these necessarily these stranger danger issues. Although as we are moving into more online There is a lot of meeting people
online. And mainstreaming, mm-hmm. getting people out more into the mainstream. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. David, among other things, your organization serves people with disabilities who are survivors of crimes such as sexual assault. And in a case where a disabled person who's intellectually disabled, I guess, reports abuse, where at what point do you step in?
Well, we will step in as soon as we get a call. Okay. We actually – my aha moment, just to back up a little bit, was I had been a victim service director for many years, and I went to a sort of regular training. Nothing strange was supposed to happen, and I started hearing the statistics that Joe has been reporting on in the NPR series. And the one that really struck me was that people with intellectual disabilities are likely to have 10 or more incidents of sexual assault in their lifetime. Wow. And that's the one – I have never heard that kind of statistic before, and that's the one that – I suddenly said, we have to change things in our community and our culture.
I mean, you were pointed out to us. Someone said, call David. Because, was it you? Okay. Because you've really developed a special program for the counties that you serve. Mm-hmm. What's different about it?
Well, first of all, you have to name it and you have to address it. And so one of the things that we did first off is just create a 24-hour crisis line. This is not for reporting crimes, which is a 911 law enforcement response, but this is for even people in the community who are saying, I saw someone who was treated wrongly. I don't know if it was a crime or not. Who can I talk to? And there was no place to call. So we created a 24-hour crisis line just for that. And then, of course, we can communicate directly with law enforcement if we need to. So that was the first thing. The other thing was to train law enforcement, because it's I call it a funnel problem. You have 1,000 crimes, of which what percent get to a prosecution?
Anyway.
Yes. So at the very end of the small end of the funnel, there's nothing there or very little. So my concern and our concern was to how do we address the criminal justice process? So there's really three things that we were trying to do. One is community education, raise the bar, the culture change. Second is how does the system work differently from the reporting and all the people who might first notice or be told about the crime, not just law enforcement. And then how do we make sure that the survivor is being treated quickly with trauma-informed care?
So, Olivia Caldera, you referred us to David Vowth. What stands out in your mind when it comes to his program?
The education on all levels and the push to get the prosecution. And I would say that one of the things that's really helpful about his program, too, is that he does address the different levels with the justice system and the on the ground,
the first responders.
Exactly.
Yeah. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you've been listening to that NPR special report on sexual assault and people who are intellectually disabled, they suffer as victims of sexual assault in the United States at more than 7 times the rate of the general population, according to the U.S. Justice Department. If you've been listening to that report, you'll be interested in this hour. We're talking to people in Ohio now about how they deal with it in Ohio and the rates in Ohio and what some of the strategies are for not only helping people cope with it and recover from it, but also prosecute it. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd especially like to hear from families and caregivers, people who know victims, and share your story and tell us what would work for you. When someone who is intellectually disabled is victimized by sexual assault, how does your job differ from other sexual assault cases?
The most important difference is the communication and trying to not only provide the trauma-informed care to them, but also to get the reporting as accurately and as quickly as possible to the investigators. So, for example, when we first started meeting with law enforcement, that was the first thing they said. So we started looking at electronic apps. What can we put on? Something easy, something cheap. Well, that became a problem because there's nothing easy, cheap. And what phone are you going to put it on? You know, how do you? So then we went to a low-tech device, and we created a less than a page size icon so that people can point. So we went through the police report, took the police report, and created icons for all of the answers to the questions. So if you can't say it, you can point. And the officer then has a blank sheet of paper who he circles what you point to so they can do a police report by simply pointing to icons.
Can you give me an example of what one of those icons looks like?
Yes. They're type of body size, color, hair,
okay.
Location of the crime on your body, any weapons, a variety of weapons they can point to, locations where it might have taken place. You can point to locations. That time of day, so there's all kinds. So you can do a police report with that communication tool.
And how did the police respond to that?
Very well. We've actually had it used. It's not supposed to be used for limited English, but all of a sudden they started using it in other ways, and we said, no, you can't do that. It's not ADA. But in an emergency, I know that they would. I mean, but it really increased the communication and the comfort level of the officer with the information he was gathering and reporting. So that was the first step of just trying to get that report into the system.
After someone's been traumatized.
Yes.
Yeah. And sooner the better?
Yes, but there really isn't any time limit in terms of, even if it has happened 10 years ago, it's still important to address it. I think one of the important things that David brought up as well is the counseling.
Yeah.
And that's something we've seen a serious deficit in terms of finding mental health professionals who are familiar with working with people with IDD, who have trauma-informed care perspective. And this idea that there's a belief or myth that people with intellectual disabilities might not benefit from counseling.
Because there's a belief that they also have some kind of emotional deficit as well.
Which could be possible. And there's people who are dually diagnosed who have intellectual disabilities and mental health issues, but they still can benefit from that. And what are some of the things that can promote resiliency and help people deal with that trauma? And those are some of the things that really need to be bolstered.
How does that counseling differ between typical and people with intellectual disabilities?
I'm not a professional counselor, so I can't answer to that specifically, but I have talked to...
I guess we're going to be hearing from one
Dr.
later on in the program,
is the key there. But I do know that Dr. Julie Gentile at Wright State does a lot of work with that, and that she says that affirmations are really important too, and helping, different types of therapy can be applied on a case-by-case basis. There isn't a cookie-cutter approach, but really kind of boosting self-esteem and recognizing patterns can be helpful.
NPR reported that the perpetrator often is another person with a disability at a group home or a day program, something like that. And I wanted to understand how you assign – I was really searching for the right word for this, but I ended up with responsibility. Not that the victim is ever responsible for a crime like that, but when both are intellectually disabled, how does that wash with what, you do, David Vowth?
Well, we will respond to any provider, family member, consumer who says that they have been a victim. And oftentimes it's from law enforcement who clues us in that we need to respond. And we will simply accept whatever they say at the time they say it or reveal to us. And we will not be making determinations of culpability or responsibility. So we don't make that at all. We will simply be peer support persons.
And when it comes to people, when you're teaching people with intellectual disabilities about things like consent and abuse, are you also speaking to people that are potential perpetrators Okay. How does that, how do you, Olivia Caldera, how do you do that?
When you say speaking to potential perpetrators, are you saying because of the peer-to-peer abuse? Well, the issue is education. And sometimes it's a lack of education that contributes to the abuse, that people might be acting out because they have been abused.
Okay.
Or maybe it's one of the many factors that Joseph Shapiro mentioned, with isolation, loneliness, and the need for affection and attention. And those are basic human needs. And sometimes it can go wrong.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about that in your classes.
Mm-hmm. And about the rights and responsibilities and accountability. And also the importance of identifying the healthy sexuality. That is something that is seriously lacking. He does talk about the sex education for people with intellectual disabilities. But if people aren't even aware of their own rights and their own sexuality, and that doesn't necessarily mean sexual intercourse, but I'm just talking about
having a boyfriend or a girlfriend,
exactly,
or whatever, or being, it might be, and having, right, feeling romantic.
Right.
Yeah.
When those things aren't addressed, you're not only continuing ignorance, but you're also making that person more vulnerable to perpetrators who rely on that ignorance.
Are parents and caregivers, particularly parents, because there's a different kind of connection there, how are they responding to these kinds of educational efforts?
It's
all over the place.
All over the place. I would say that there are definitely some parents who are advocating and wanting to educate their adult children to know as much as possible, because they know that they can't watch or protect them 24/7. And that the importance of allowing people to experience things. On the other hand, there are parents who will not, parents and also direct service providers, who are the gatekeepers, and they provide barriers because they don't feel that the person is high enough functioning to understand it, or that their innocence might be tarnished.
Like, just leave it alone, let it go. Do you find that?
Yes. There's another side, that if you don't want a person to experience the opportunities that affection bring, you also may not believe that the harm that's caused them means much to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've actually run public service announcements on TV in our area simply saying, this hurts, and having people with intellectual disabilities on the TV PSA saying, a variety of people saying, this does hurt me emotionally and physically, and it seems strange that we would have to make that a point. But if you think of a person with a disability as somehow not having all the same emotions, mm-hmm, then that problem exists.
And, of course, that comes from a long history of dehumanizing people with intellectual disabilities. It's been ingrained in our culture for probably hundreds of years. We'll continue our conversation. We're going to include a psychologist who specializes in these issues. So if you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about sexual assault of people who are intellectually disabled and light of an NPR investigative series entitled Abused and Betrayed. The series revealed that people who are intellectually disabled are sexually assaulted at a rate more than 7 times higher than those without such disabilities. The series also covered how such cases are prosecuted much less frequently. Check out the series at the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides and listen for 3 more segments of that series next week. Still with us is Executive Director of Crime Victim Services serving Allen and Putnam counties in central northwest Ohio, David Vouth, and Community Connector for the Center for Disability Empowerment, Olivia Caldera. Joining us now by phone is the Director of the Disability and Abuse Project at the Spectrum Institute. That's an educational nonprofit based in California. Clinical psychologist Dr. Nora Baladarian. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Your practice focuses on trauma and abuse, and you train first responders, agency personnel, and service providers. What is your understanding of how well-trained such professionals are when it comes to sexual assault of people who are intellectually disabled?
My experience is that such training is quite rare. And although the people who do come want to learn, their opportunity is very, very constricted. So there's no regular training, as one might think, in terms of how to interact and approach individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and or how to interview them, or understanding a variety of communication disabilities, and how those communication disabilities might be interacting with the trauma that the person just experienced. So we have a lot of work to do into incorporating that topic into regular training. One of the other things I learned from the police is that once one does training, for example, their staff might be quickly reassigned to a whole nother aspect of work. Like now they're going to work burglary, or they're going to do homicides, or they're going to do auto crashes or something. So that training gets lost very quickly. So I think that it should not only be initially provided, but it should be provided for everyone who comes into the areas that where it is likely that those skills are going to be needed.
David Vouth, you're nodding when Dr. Baladarian is saying that. You know what she's talking about.
We were so proud to have trained every single law enforcement officer in our county, from parks officers, park district, to sheriffs, to police, of all the different municipalities. And then we realized there's a shelf life for that.
Yeah.
People change, and there's a comfort level that we were building in the training, but that comfort level leaves. And so you still not only have to do the training, but help people realize that they can handle this, officers.
I would imagine, Dr. Baladarian, that it's a lot like just the whole issue of mental health and mental health issues in general, right? And dealing with people who are mentally ill. As far as not the same kind of training, but the fact that it's kind of a somewhat new concept to be training law enforcement on these issues.
In 2005, I think it was, under a grant from the Office for Victims of Crime, we developed a training film that can be used. It's a 55-minute film called something like Victims of Crime, Victims with Disabilities, The Forensic Interview.
Huh.
And it comes with a little guidebook so that any police officer or training officer within those response professions that David was mentioning can easily lead a discussion after watching the film of the variety of different communication issues, sensitivities, and a variety of disabilities. So training can be ongoing, even just by using this 55-minute film, which is actually broken up into 6-minute sections. So for roll call training, it can be done over, say, a period of time, say 2 weeks. So training can be ongoing. So far as I know, it isn't, but it could be.
Hmm. Just a running training process.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And it's all printed out. So if a person does better by reading it, they can read that. But I think sometimes the visual of how an officer actually does interact with people with different kinds of disabilities is very instructive.
Olivia Caldera, you wanted to talk a little bit more about the issue of human trafficking in all of this and the grooming phase and how sometimes that's misunderstood and is important.
Thank you. The grooming is essentially gaining somebody's trust and preying on somebody who's vulnerable and giving them things, telling them you love them, different ways of making them feel comfortable and loved and they trust you. And then once that trust is developed, the abuser has power and control. And sometimes that can lead to human trafficking. And sometimes we don't think of people with intellectual disabilities as being part of human trafficking. But they are, in fact, because there's labor trafficking and sex trafficking,
yeah,
two different types. But it's often just not very apparent. It's not on the radar, but it is something that is occurring. And I don't have statistics for that in Ohio.
Which is even more horrible in some ways. Why is it different? Why is it not on the radar?
I went to a presentation by the Ohio Human Trafficking Task Force, and they have limited staff and they have a lot going on. And they said that it wasn't quite on their radar yet because of the communication issues of not knowing whether somebody, are they on drugs? Is that why their speech is this way? You know, how, and then also who their guardian is. Because of those issues of consent and agency, that it's the default, if somebody has an intellectual disability and they're not their own guardian, is to talk to their guardian or parental figure. But sometimes the guardian or the parental figure is the one who's
doing
the crime. And so that's another thing that is tricky.
Dr. Beladirian, what are the signs of abuse that parents and caregivers should be familiar with, assuming that they're not the abuser in the first place? But, you know, what should people look for? How do you know? Is it on a case-by-case basis? Do you have to know the person, or are there other things? We talked earlier about acting out and that kind of a thing in different programs.
In terms of signs of abuse, the typical signs of abuse is basically the list. But people with developmental disabilities may exhibit signs of abuse in other additional ways as well. You talk about sexual acting out. Often people don't understand that term, acting out.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is actually is reenacting what happened to them. They're not doing something bad. They're showing by doing what has happened to them. But what you want to look at is any change in personality, activity, refusal to take off their clothes for bedtime and then change again for daytime, things that are more subtle, change in appetite, change in how what they will eat. I had a client who changed from eating regular food to only imbibing anything that could go through a straw. And she wouldn't eat anything else. There's an example. Someone changing from being very gregarious to angry. So changes from the normal person into different kinds of moods that are unusual for them. And some people signal it by doing self-enactment, self-reenactment. They're really looking for a change. It's very, very unusual for there to be absolutely no change in the person, for example, not wanting to get on a bus or not wanting to go to work or not wanting to be with a particular person. You have to be very sensitive to these changes. And sometimes people tell you straight out, and I've worked on cases where the individual told their counselor, And the counselor said, wrote it down and said, okay, well, it's important to talk about that. And that was the end of it.
You mean so, they actually told their counselor, so-and-so?
Yes, my roommate is raping me every night. I don't like it. That was what he said. And
wow.
The counselor wrote it down and said, okay, well, good for you for, you know, talking about it, basically, and we'll continue talking about this in counseling.
I mean, did the counselor in that case, did the counselor not take this seriously, or what was going on there?
Well, I never spoke to the counselor, so I really don't know.
Okay.
But I do know that the nightly rapes continued for quite a while. And I think he told somebody else, and then they took action and took him to the hospital. And what was interesting at the hospital was that the ER doc only spoke to the person who brought individual to the hospital, not talking to the hospital, sort of what I think Olivia, did you say her name is?
Yeah.
Olivia was referring to as not talking to the individual themselves, even though he could talk. But they only spoke to the guardian, and the guardian was a staff person, and he did not know about the kinds of sexual assault that were occurring. Therefore, the doctor did not make a referral for a rape kit, therefore all evidence was lost. So, you know, this has a kind of rebounding effect. So the signs that you're looking for, we have this on our website. I developed a program called Physicians Education Campaign to help physicians spot signs of abuse and to respond to those, because often people are not asked. Individuals who are verbal, they're not asked about whether or not they're experiencing any sexual assault. They're just not asked. And we're encouraging physicians to know what the signs are for people who are nonverbal, but also to directly ask about difficulties they may be experiencing. They may not know the word abuse per se,
mm-hmm.
but they sure know words like being touched that they don't like, or being hurt, or are they scared, or are they afraid of any particular person or location, things like that.
How do you help somebody describe assault, help somebody prosecute assault without coaching them and tainting, I guess, the testimony, tainting the story?
Well, one would ask the questions, and I think that you simply ask the question and write down what the answer is. You know, were you touched by someone in a way that you didn't like? That's not coaching.
Okay.
And if there's a yes answer, then you just kind of follow that path. And if you use a drawing, a standardized interviewing drawing, you ask them, what do you call this? Like the eye, you know, so you do a few things that are usually known. Where's the nose? Where's your foot? You know, and you mark those off. And then you say, can you show me where you were touched that you didn't like? And then the person can show you on that same drawing mm-hmm. where they were touched that they didn't like.
David Bell, forgive me. Have we talked about that medical piece of all of this, the emergency room moment?
No, we haven't. But Nora's bringing up the point of the importance of evidence collection.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm very hopeful about in Ohio that's developing is increased knowledge by physicians and ERs to at least call rape crisis centers. And also the place that a lot of the evidence is collected is at child advocacy centers. And I realize that many of the people we're talking about are not children.
Right.
But these are places where the forensic interviews are being done and the forensic medical collection is being done. And it's being videotaped, which means they only have to report this once.
Okay. David Bell, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
David Bouth is Executive Director of Crime Victim Services serving Allen and Putnam Counties. Also, Olivia Caldera, thanks to you as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Ann.
Olivia Caldera is the Community Connector for the Center for Disability Empowerment. And Dr. Nora Balladerian, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for doing this show. So important.
Thank you. Dr. Nora Baladarian is a clinical psychologist and the director of the Disability and Abuse Project. We'll have links to all three of those organizations. We'll also have links to the NPR series that's airing this week and three more episodes next week on the incidents and our response to reports of sexual assault of people with intellectual disabilities. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.